we hope you found the four episodes on racism and anti-racism helpful in forming your conceptualizations of how racism impacts on students with refugee experience and what can be done to ameliorate its effects. To tie together the four episodes and leave you with some concluding remarks, we welcome back START School Liaison Counsellor Rafiq Tanios.
So just to conclude this thematic season on the impacts of racism on people from refugee experience and how to respond to that, I just want to begin by reminding everyone that what we're actually talking about is something that has been studied and is in the evidence base, and it's been studied anthropologically, psychologically, sociologically at many different levels. So we're not reinventing or talking about things. We're talking about things from the evidence base and trying to link them to people's lived experience and anecdotal stories. And so far, we've kind of looked at the systemic level and then the institutional level, the interpersonal level, and the personal levels of how racism presents at those levels. When we're talking specifically about people with refugee experience, we're talking about a history of the nation state that we now call Australia that was built on a siege mentality. And in 1901, one of the impetus or drivers towards federation was really about eliminating non-white, non-British, non-English-speaking migration to the country through the colonies. That was one of the major drivers towards federation. Not the only driver, but one of the major drivers. And from the beginning, there was the systemic context, the ideas, the knowledge, the ways of talking about people that were reproduced in science and in education, presented internally Aboriginal people as not fitting in with the white nation, and externally people of brown skins or different cultural backgrounds not belonging to the white nation. And one of the goals was to create a nation that was the offspring of the British Empire, that was white, and that would prove that, you know, there was a racial significance in having a nation that was all white. So we have a series of immigration restriction laws that affect people arriving here from brown, black backgrounds, culturally diverse backgrounds. In some ways, I think it can be argued, and we can see how that extends to some of the immigration debates we've had over the last 15, 20 years, beginning with the change that the Howard government introduced in its talk about asylum seekers, and presenting them falsely, we now know through the Tampa incident, as putting at risk their own children to get here. So really presenting them in a malevolent light, that these are people that prepare to hurt their own children to take advantage of us, Australia. And that's really problematic, right? Because that's attached a kind of anxiety and fear and built on the historical things that we've received from the past, the social knowledge, the historical knowledge that still exists in stories and in the learning of particularly the older generation, you know, what they learned at school. So we are dealing with that when we're talking about the experiences of racism at a systemic level for people of refugee experience. We're talking about that at an institutional level. So at the institutional level, we might see elements of that play out, but definitely at the interpersonal level, people do carry socially, not everyone, but people do carry a racialized perspective around refugees, and refugees have told us that anecdotally they don't like the term, they don't like people finding out that they may be refugees. Now, not to say not all refugees experience racism, and it may not be so, but there are situations where people do experience casual racism from people around them, but also the scrutiny that comes from institutional racism, the kind of being noticed more by, let's say, authority figures, the being not accommodated in institutional processes, yeah, and intolerance towards the fact that you might not know how the social norms work, or you might not know how to stand in a line properly. And we don't have a articulated system for helping people learn that very complex intercultural transition to the social norms and what's accepted in our institutional processes. We don't have systems that really support people through that. We have some limited English speaking that has some cultural elements that's provided, but the rest people expected to work out on their own. And it's very complex to be able to move from one way of viewing the world and viewing yourself to this new way while you're dealing with refugee trauma that's affected the way your brain operates while you're in recovery and while you're dealing with resettlement. So at the institutional level, we don't really have the accommodations and supports that tell us that we understand that refugee people are important and can be included. We do have many supports, so it's a work in progress, and we do have many programs that assist, but we don't have a uniform across all levels of government, across our own social systems that helps people understand the refugee experience that's intentioned and pursued by, let's say, the authorities, government. It's kind of left to people to do that, not for government services. And you might see this again as an aspect of historical racism, that there isn't the same equality or fairness in distribution of resources in how we do these things. And lastly, at the personal level, so let's go down to the experiences of the person, particularly children and young people, and that's our focus here. Already there have been wounds. There may have been chronic exposure to a traumatic experience. So there's a sensory load that's there. There's a change in the brain systems, particularly those systems implicated in learning, memory systems and the hippocampus, the limbic system, to do with mood and how we kind of respond to the world, reactivity. So those things have been affected by affected in children and young people who have been exposed to chronic trauma. What that means is when they're exposed to racial trauma or racial attacks that can lead to racial trauma, we're talking about already there's a sensitivity. There's already a heightened sensitivity because of the experiences of being a refugee, which is kind of being moved around against your will, a rejection of some aspect of your identity. And if you don't have the protective factors in place, if you're an unaccompanied minor without the support of, let's say, responsive, attuned, consistently supporting parents or a community, racism is going to have a more significant impact on you. And it's going to sit on that existing trauma and self-doubt and shame. And it's going to attach it now to a visceral element and to your sense of belonging in this new community. If you're a black child or a black young person, and it's going to attach to your skin color, and attached to that are those racial tropes around smell, around physical prowess, around threat, African gangs that came through the kind of political narratives that we used to create a little bit of social panic. Then what you're going to get is young people who are not going to behave in pro-social ways, because they're going to look for respect and belonging, and they'll find that in ways that our society deems antisocial, because they can't find respect and acceptance in the normal, traditional, ordinary ways of seeking that respect. They're going to carry around that sense of rejection, resentment, and it's going to affect their integration opportunities. So it's really critical, I think, that at the institutional level, we recognize that there's a reality to racism that plays out casually, plays out institutionally, plays out interpersonally, and plays out systemically. And that denial, we can't stand and judge the experiences of these children and young people from our reference point, because that's judgmentalism and ethnocentrism. We have to actually be open to the stories and be curious to learn from them about what their bodily experiences are. And I think if we can cultivate that attunement, so whether we're at school or whether we're working with young people, instead of denying, dismissing, reframing, just sitting with that very painful experience, acknowledging it, recognizing that their world is something they've experienced that I might not be able to understand or judge, and then checking with them what supports they need is the first step. The second step to that is really getting them into some sort of support where there's a therapeutic assessment around racial resilience and that they can be supported not only for the trauma they experience from being from the refugee experience, but also from these added elements or these added wounds from racial trauma. Because when we do our assessment as clinicians and as support workers and therapeutic workers, it'll give us a window into another layer of the engagement that these children and young people need, particularly in situations where they're isolated, they don't have the same protective factors. So often what I see is not so much in Sydney where, you know, there's such a large community from the same ethnic or cultural group that they do find strength and meaning and identity in that group. I'm really thinking of those people who are isolated from that kind of support and who may even be marginalised from their own traditional community. So if you think about young women, unaccompanied young women, you're talking about a demographic that may not choose to fulfil the assumed collective role, gender role, that their community expects of them. Because often women are expected to carry the culture. So they may be expected to dress a certain way, behave a certain way. And they may find personal recovery and freedom in this individualist social norm environment that they're growing up in school, where they can make choices and they can dress the way they wish to dress. And so I think that particular group is a demographic we have to think of as a high risk, because if they do suffer racial trauma, they have no community to buffer that. And the community that they do find accepting and they've embraced, which is the dominant institutional group that they've met, probably British heritage teachers who care for them and are thoughtful about their needs, will not be able to see that dimension of their world and will be awkward and uncomfortable. That's been my experience when these things are raised. There's an awkwardness and discomfort around dealing with racial issues. And that's because we're ashamed of the history, and that's because internally some people have resistance and disbelief and other people don't think it's so serious and other people do think it's serious but don't know what to do. There's so much complexity around this as a society because we haven't grasped it, we haven't dealt with it. We're still dealing with issues of treaty, colonization, constitutional recognition that are divisive, that are used as divisive tools when they're actually tools that bring us together to recognize the stories of people who've suffered in our community and include their stories like we include the other stories and be able to listen to those stories and respect what they tell us. So I think there needs to be an assessment of what aspect of racial trauma. And children and young people who experience it often don't have a language to talk about it. So we need to introduce linguistic tools to talk about racial trauma, to help them understand. And again, it's a complex field. And you go to the evidence base, you understand that the elements of, that are ethnocentric, that are cultural, that are just personal values, judgmentalism or non-judgment. So there is a need to learn from people who can offer the training and offer the learning. And then there's a need to learn from the people who tell the stories. And I think when we bring those things together with willingness, we're able at least as first responders to acknowledge, to recognise and to seek the supports that will provide what young people who experience racial trauma need. And often the other level of complexity is between racialised groups. So you might see conflict between young Aboriginal kids and kids who've just arrived as refugees from the Congo, from some other ethnic or ancestral country. And again, that's a different problem that we need to deal with. That's, again, a complexity that requires us to untangle that one group has needs, the other group has needs, and those needs can be contradictory in their access to resources in a school or institutional environment. And so there's a particular approach that we need to take to that. So having looked at all the different levels of how racism is expressed as a reality that we've inherited from the past and looked at the evidence that we need to use language and knowledge that anthropologists, psychologists have put together for us to use in analysis and in responding to these needs, we're at the point now of saying, let's recognise the impact of racism on children and young people and the developmental risks that creates, how it ostracizes them from belonging in our society and leaves them with increased pain. And let's agree that we need, as first responders, to acknowledge that it's real and that people need to be at the center of any process that deals with their experiences of racial trauma. And as professionals, we need to develop our interracial, our racial literacy. And as therapists and clinicians, we need to have a focus on developing racial resilience in children and young people who might be at risk or don't have the protection.